It took us 30 years to say that. Let's let's let that sink in. It took us 30 years to say that, you know what? Maybe we gotta burn less carbon. Music. My name's Alex Lee.
And I'm Simona Capisani.
And this is A Hostile Climate.
And on this episode, we're talking about an annual event that's the largest multilateral climate negotiations, often referred to as COP.
So COP stands for the Conference of the Parties. It's an international meeting where parties that signed on to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, the UNFCCC, come together to discuss international climate policy. It's divisive and arguably really important. Today, we're going to talk to a climate journalist, as well as a philosopher and an economist who attended the most recent Conference of the Parties, the most recent COP, COP28, which was held in Dubai last year. The fact that this meeting was held in a city in the United Arab Emirates, a globally huge oil producer, might give you an idea as to why this event might be so controversial. So let's get going.
But yeah, Alex, before we even get into the controversy and the updates from this COP, it might be helpful for the audience if we just give a really small primer on the history of COPs. And so maybe it might be helpful if I just give the fastest, briefest history and see if I can do so in a short amount of time. But
all right, 30 years in 1 minute, go. Simona, how did we get here?
Well, Alex, it all started 28 years ago, but maybe we don't have a lot of time to go through it, so maybe I'll just give the greatest hits.
The greatest hits of international climate negotiation. What's on the Essential Album?
Okay, so the White Album. No, now five. What is this?
Climate Change Now, sorry. Volume 28.
Now 28. No one under the age of 30 is going to get that.
If you're in your 20s, ask your parents.
Okay. Jesus Christ. Anyway, it all starts in Berlin for the first COP in the mid-90s, 1995. And this first gathering, right, was a coming together to be able to talk about that way. Maybe we need to be able to negotiate to strengthen a global response to climate change. So at the time, there was just a kind of stated commitment that really was only applying to developed countries, despite the fact that there was universal participation in the conversations, that some of these developed countries need to agree to submit details on how they're going to limit their anthropogenic, human-caused emissions to try to jumpstart this global coordination.
So just real quick, here, like, we didn't solve the problem. We didn't solve climate change at COP1 in 1995. So no. We decided that, well, as an international community, let's just get together every year.
Right, because maybe this party's going to have to continue.
Let's keep the party rolling.
And the party was like a huge bummer the following year in COP2, so I'm not even going to talk about it. But COP3 at Kyoto in 97, with COP2 kind of being this bit of a failure to identify actually quantitative targets that, we need to hit for our emissions reductions. The world reconvenes in Kyoto, and the delegates negotiate the first huge COP deal, right? And the kind of main aim of this COP was target setting of emissions. That was both the principal aim and a major achievement. And something that is notable, too, was that though there was heavy responsibility about developed countries, developing countries were actually included within the scope of action.
This is something folks have likely heard about. If you've heard about the Kyoto Protocol, personally, one of my favorite international protocols. That's what Simona's talking about right now. We ditched protocols after Kyoto, though.
We did.
As we continue fast forwarding, we moved on to accords and agreements.
And agreements, yeah. I don't know if protocol, maybe everyone, it was just like too traumatic. Because the U.S., major important party here, right, decides to not ratify it.
Largest historical emitter. And at the time, largest annual emitter.
Yeah, exactly. And they were pissed off in part because India and China were exempt because they held a developing status at the time. And so the U.S., for a range of reasons, was like, if they're not going to be on the hook, we're not agreeing to it. And this rolls out, gets ratified, or gets, I guess, operationalized, rather, in 2005, but, you know, was really limited because of the U.S. not being a party to it. All right, fast forward 10 years, a lot of interesting stuff. Us environmental politics nerds love to talk about it, but we probably just want to mention really quickly the kind of big major change in history with multilateral action on climate change that happened at COP21 at Paris in 2015. And this is the first time you see another legally binding international treaty on climate change since Kyoto. But rather than that small number of states in Kyoto, 37, right, to be exact, that signed on, in the Paris Agreement, you had 196 countries signing on to the agreement.
It's almost all the countries.
And Alex, this is very explicit, right? So in order for us to actually get to a place where 97% of global emissions were being accounted for in this agreement, right, it required a kind of shift in how we think about both accountability and how parties join in to do this kind of agreement making and negotiating. So basically, you get this historic moment, right, in multilateralism by people being able to come together to actually agree to this. I think it's important to note, and Alex, you meant why people like protocols and or they like agreements rather than protocols, right? The kind of more technical way to understand that is that you've had these kinds of driving principle across climate negotiations, often referred to as common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, which is just expert talk to say that lots of different countries are in lots of different kinds of conditions and have different abilities to be able to meet their nationally declared contributions, their NDCs, what they're willing to do to try to hit this target. And so rather than debating on how we should share burdens and efforts and costs a la the protocol, you have this kind of bottom up volunteering where each country is invited to propose a contribution that they say that they're ready to aim to get to. And also, a really important mechanism to mention in light of where we're at now is this, what we call a ratcheting up, a ratcheting effect of Paris, where we want to make sure that our climate actions are ambitious, right, and are increasingly progressive over time. So at Paris, we agreed that every 5 years we would take stock, otherwise codified as the global stock take, GST, would happen every 5 years from Paris as a check-in to see, are we on track? Are different countries, can they ramp up what they're doing, etc. So that not so short history brings us to COP28.
Well, and then, of course, you know, we were in Paris, then we were out of Paris, now we're back in Paris.
Yeah, right.
maybe the final important thing I might want to throw in there is in 2022, a year before COP28, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, as part of its sixth assessment report, released the sort of most dire call for climate action we've seen out of the international scientific community that suggested we really need massive reductions in greenhouse gas emissions in the next decade in order to avoid 2 degrees of warming.
Negotiations may be getting better, climate getting worse.
Dire backdrop, right? That's that's the backdrop against which this meeting was held.
Right. So, Alex, COP28.
COP28, let's talk to some folks who were there. I'm hoping after 30 years that we've got this one worked out. It's in the bag. So now it's time to make something happen, right?
Well, I do, on that count, I have some good news for you.
Yeah.
Because one of the biggest headlines, right, coming out of this year's COP was that almost every single country in the world, almost all the countries, right, for the first time ever in this entire period of time, 28 years, has agreed to, I quote, transition away from fossil fuels.
Yeah, I mean,
why? You don't look very excited.
It took us 28 years to get there. I mean, do I need to say it? It took us 30 years to say that. Let's let that sink in. It took us 30 years to say that. You know what? Maybe we gotta burn less carbon. So we're going to jump in to some other perspectives on this year's COP. Our first guest is Alexandria Herr. Alexandria is a climate journalist and researcher.
And she does this really cool thing. She has this new tradition of writing a piece for the magazine Atmos, where she takes one of the major dictionary words of the year and applies it to COP. So in 2023, Cambridge Dictionary's word of the year was hallucinate. And we're going to pick up there with Alexandria.
I mean, for this piece in particular, I was really trying to untangle this for myself. And I think I clarified a lot of my own thoughts about COP, like, through writing this piece. This was the second piece of this type that I've written. Like, I wrote a similar one last year for Atmos. And basically the idea is that last year and this year, I've taken the word of the year and tried to connect it back to climate change. So last year it was permacrisis, and that was pretty easy. The hallucination prompt, I guess, was like a bit harder, but I think that made for like a more interesting framework through which to think through the COP process. And I think back to the question of like, was COP good or bad, the right framework to like understand COP? That wasn't really the framework through which I was approaching trying to understand this year's COP, because I was kind of starting from this place of like, there is this massive level of fossil fuel influence over this process, and like just taking that for the starting place. And rather than trying to understand, well, does that mean this year's COP will be good or bad? I was trying to understand, well, what does that mean for how this process is going to take place in the language that's going to be used there? And I think that what was really interesting about trying to understand the role of the fossil fuel industry at this year's COP is that I think in one way you could see it, I'm not going to say it's a good thing, but you could kind of interpret it as they feel threatened. Like the fossil fuel industry does feel threatened, maybe for the first time in a very real way, the fact that they're showing up with this amount of force at COP, because it really was truly an unprecedented amount of representation from the fossil fuel industry at this year's COP process. And so I guess I just wanted to understand, like, how does that distort language? Like, and how does that distort how people understand the COP process as well? Because I think there were a lot of very celebratory headlines that came out of the first round of coverage on COP. Like the New York Times was like, how an oil man led the, I can't remember the exact headline, but it was like how an oil man led, brokered the first climate deal or something. And I was like, what does this mean? Like, what if you peel back just like the first layer of language, like what assumptions, what influence is like hiding underneath it, I guess.
Well, that's really interesting. That's something that I haven't thought about. You just changed how I am thinking about this year's COP. I think we've gotten really hung up on what COP does, and maybe don't spend enough time thinking about how these kinds of negotiations reflect something that's already happening or reflect the state of the world, right? And maybe that's more its sort of value. But with that in mind, what do you think the role of these sorts of negotiations is going forward? What's the place for COP over the next 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, that's a hard question. I think especially because we're already looking at next year's COP being in another like oil rich place with a lot of, there's almost certainly going to be a lot of oil industry influence on, and this isn't new. I mean, obviously in Poland, there was like the role of coal at COP, and and so I think it's a difficult question. And I guess like this year was the first global stock take, so we'll see like how that continues to evolve. But I guess like for me, what's most interesting is like seeing how the fossil fuel industry's tactics and language will continue to change, because I think there is this recognition that some type of transition is coming. But how can that transition be sort of massaged to fit the interests of industry? And I think that's sort of what I was looking for in this piece. And I think it'll be hard to predict how that's going to evolve in the next couple of years. But one of the things that we've already been seeing is sort of this transition from sort of outright denial or rejection of climate change and the energy transition to these kind of softer, more subtle ways of inserting doubt or influence into the process. So not saying like, oh, well, climate change isn't happening and we don't need to think about it, but instead saying, well, climate change is happening and we need to have a transition, but the oil and gas industry needs to have a role in that transition, or it's inevitable that we're going to continue to produce oil and gas, and or that renewables are just unreliable, so we need these transition fuels. And I think that Naomi Oreskes has been, her work and like analysis of how that framing has changed has been really prescient in identifying like that was exactly the shift that we saw at this year's COP. Like this, that sort of fossil fuel savior frame, as she calls it, was what was like coming out of this year's fossil fuel presence at COP.
I mean, one thing that they do really well, right, the fossil fuel industry, is to, you know, make these energy systems seen as a type of, you know, they naturalize them, right? They're inevitable. They're almost like a natural kind that have always existed. You know, the fossil fuel industry was even, you know, providing educational material for schools to, like, embed, you know, national identity and what it is to be an American sort of around this kind of thing. And you just see the way that it's, you know, it continues to evolve, but be able to continue to, like, set the narrative and drive the narrative of this kind of inevitability of the role. And I found that what's, like, so frustrating is we know that it's happening. Like, I can see it, you know, and those of us that are perceiving it. And, you know, I think of the Biden administration, you know, in this evaluation and this, you know, election year kind of reflected back in these same kinds of frustrations where you've got the IRA and you've got a lot of this progress on, in some respects, but then you just have the potential, you know, authorization of 20 new LNG, you know, liquid natural gas terminals. And it's just the fact that you're going to continue to invest in new fossil fuel infrastructure.
For me, that's sort of like the central contradiction of climate politics, like, or like, if you want to use the word of the year for 2023, like the central hallucination of climate politics, there is this like cleaving of the problem from the source, that everybody's talking about climate change, but there's very little talk about demand reduction. And I think like the focus, I'm not saying that, you know, there's no role for demand side policy. Demand side policy is very important, but I think there also needs to be this role of looking at supply and where at our energy sources. And that's why it was such a big deal that the term fossil fuels was even included in this year's global stocktake, and because it never has been before in any COP. But it's also just like this bizarre like refusal to talk about the root cause of the problem. And again, that is an intentional move by the oil and gas industry to sort of disappear the link between fossil fuels itself and carbon emissions. So the CEO of Exxon, Darren Woods, was for the first time at this year's COP, and he just kept like making this really bizarre distinction between climate change and fossil fuels. And so he basically said that like COP28 was putting way too much emphasis on getting rid of fossil fuels, oil and gas. And he said, I actually think that part of the thing that has slowed us down is this focus on making a step change and getting out of our existing energy system and starting something brand new. So essentially like somehow taking the climate crisis and putting the blame back on renewable energy. It's this amazing trick of language and framing. And it's very, I mean, to their credit, it is a very like creative tactic.
Well, it says something about the power of the stories we tell. Right. If we tell the right story, then the whole problem orientation changes. We can shift it away from something about, you know, deep challenges of human self-control and deep challenges of the cost of the current technological state of our society and deep challenges of like power invested in these sorts of corporations and industries into something that seems cursory almost. Right. We can almost, it's almost like they're trying to make the problem go away by redefining it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it drives me insane because every time I feel like I open my YouTube these days, I get an ad for like from Exxon about like how green Exxon is. And I feel like, I mean, it is kind of textbook greenwashing, but it's also a little bit more complicated than that, because I think so much of this type of twisting happens in these very technical, like these very technical domains that I think the average person would not understand the frame shift that's happening. Like these distinctions that are being drawn between like abated and unabated coal, like trying to sanitize coal with these kind of technical terms. And like for the average person, like all these distinctions between green, blue, gray, hydrogen mean nothing. And even like the language that was the most hotly contested language at COP of like phase down versus phase out, like to most people that sounds the same. And so having these debates relegated or like transformed into the realm of these very hyper technical like climate specifics means that like it's invisible to most people.
You know, it's funny when I've, you know, students come into class and I have to make the case that it could actually be a philosophy problem, right? And I think
or a communication problem.
or a communication problem, right? Or, you know, and I think they might have a sense increasingly, I mean, they do, like my students definitely do have a sense that it's a political problem, right? I think that's become very salient because there's this idea where like, we don't need further scientific evidence, right, to do something about it. So why is action not happening? So that must mean it's not merely a scientific problem. But I wonder like in the different mediums, you know, that you're using to communicate about this, is there any way to like wrestle back the technocratic space, you know, that kind of language that obscures and then can kind of control the moral space of talking about it?
Yeah. I think before I answer that question, I want to latch onto this thing that you're saying about technocratic, like the way that climate change is transformed into a technocratic problem of global management. I think that is very interesting to me because it doesn't sit well with the physical realities of our Earth system. Like, we are transforming what is essentially like a transformation of our biosphere into this problem of like, well, how far can we turn up or down the thermostat? How many emissions exactly do we need to turn up or down the thermostat, and where can we stop? And obviously that excludes the majority of people who are affected by problems of climate change on the front lines. It excludes, you know, grassroots activists who have the most personal stake in this issue. But I think beyond that, that's why, I mean, in some of my other writing, I've been really focused on this question of climate tipping points. And I think climate tipping points really doesn't, the concept of it, which is that basically climate change is not a linear phenomenon necessarily. And there's more and more science coming out to say that it may actually be a nonlinear phenomenon. So we can't just turn up the emissions dial a certain amount, expect to see a linear amount of warming. We might actually enter these feedback loops, which might accelerate the amount of warming that we're experiencing and then kind of be set off onto this other trajectory of the biosphere that we might not be able to control. And so this question of like planetary management and control, I think, is really central to the understanding of what our responsibility is and what the potential like impacts of our like global management system is, because the idea of a linear temperature that we are turning the dial on does not sit well with the idea of nonlinear tipping points. And so I think it reinserts like more possibilities for climate action of like, if we're not sitting at the thermostat on spaceship Earth that we are controlling neatly, then we need to make space for more types of climate action, more grassroots types of climate action to kind of successfully get a wrangle on this problem.
I have a follow-up question that I think this is the hard question, I guess. What does it mean to successfully grapple with the problem, though? Like, what does success look like to you, I guess?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer for that, but I do think that like the way that our sort of process of climate governance excludes many of those who are most impacted by the problem. Like in this COP, we had the issue where I think it was the delegation of small island states was excluded from the room when the final global stocktake text was accepted. And I think that basically like it kind of calls into question like the success of like this idea of turning the temperature thermostat up and down, and that being the way that we do climate governance and politics, and maybe says, okay, well, maybe the way that we need to approach this is centering those that are most affected first and kind of having a more democratic and open way of managing this problem rather than letting the fossil fuel executives hash it out with the heads of state around a table. I think that the technocratic managerial language depoliticizes climate change. It makes it into like just this management problem, just this engineering problem, as you said earlier. And it removes the political element of what are the root causes of this problem. What are the root causes sourcing from the inequalities embedded in capitalism and embedded in the legacies of colonialism? And I think a tipping points view of climate kind of helps us like understanding that the Earth system is dynamic and that the impacts of climate change are dynamic kind of also helps us with that repoliticizing of the climate change issue, like looking more at the root causes and understanding what are the tipping points in our human systems that we can start to create, that we can start to move towards to counter the tipping points that are happening in our Earth systems. But to your question earlier about like how I grapple with this as a writer, sometimes I don't think that I need to grapple with it as a writer always, because I think that everybody can look around and see that climate change is happening way faster than we anticipated. And to see like these, to kind of like listen to the deliberations at COP and see the headlines about, you know, like the very slow pace of climate action that we've had, and then look outside and see that there's no snow, see that we're the hottest year in 120,000 years. Like, I think everybody is experiencing this internal feeling of unease, or like understanding that something is not matching up between like the symptoms of the problem and the way that we're addressing it.
Well, hang on. I'm going to play devil's advocate for just a minute. So I admit to falling victim to this kind of pessimism we've been talking about. And I agree that there seems to be this huge sort of technologification of this problem, to make up a word, right? But I could also say like, well, hang on, now we have to fix like democracy and global inequality. That seems way harder. Like that seems like the deepest problem in human coordination, is how we distribute power, right? And so, well, if we have to fix that to avoid some of these big systems, like Earth systems tipping points, like why isn't that just a harder problem? I don't know. That's my devil's advocate question.
I think for me, it's actually an exciting opportunity. Like, it's more of a place to say, look, like, I think there's a lot of people who, I mean, and I don't think people really have this viewpoint in 2024, because it's impossible to look around and say that you're not impacted by climate change. But I think before, like maybe 10 years ago or 5 years ago, there was this kind of viewpoint of like, well, I can't really care that much about climate change because I have so many other things to worry about. Like, there's housing and there's economic inequality and there's like health injustice and racial injustice and other types of environmental injustice. How could I make room to care about climate change? That's a problem for the future. But I think connecting climate change to those other issues that you're mentioning allows people an entry point to view how all of these systems are connected with each other and how, in fact, the solutions to one could be the solutions to many. And so I think it's actually a broadening of the possibilities of climate action. And I think when we talk about social tipping points, it also helps bring more people in to viewing how all these different conditions are interconnected. And I think like, understanding the fragility and the instability of our climate system and our potential climate future also kind of interjects the possibility for broader forms of climate action and climate action that I think that we see at COP every year, where it's like people who are not necessarily the biggest decision makers also have a big presence at COP and are advocating for themselves to be included in the futures that COP is making.
Well, here's kind of a journalist question for you, or question for you as someone who covers climate more broadly. So COP is an institution, right? It's a particular framework that brings together a particular institution for a particular kind of negotiation. Where else are you looking when you want to cover on the ground climate solutions and climate action? Like, is it just broadly trying to understand, hey, where's local action and regional action taking place? Or are there like particular bright spots that you think are, hey, this is what I'm watching outside of COP?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've never been someone who, when I like as a reporter, was super interested in covering like necessarily like federal policy or like I was writing about COP because I was interested in this word of the year thing. I'm not somebody who usually covers COP. For me, when I was looking around and reporting as a journalist, I was always like really looking literally around me, like where I was. So when I was living in Los Angeles, I was covering a lot of the oil stuff in LA and California and some of the wildfire stuff. And when I was in Minneapolis, I was covering a lot of the stuff that was going on in northern Minnesota with the Line 3 pipeline. And I just think that, you know, at this point, like, like I said earlier, like everybody understands that climate change is happening and it's impacting them. And so I've always wanted to look at it in the places that I'm most connected to and the places where I can look around me and see most immediately what's happening on the ground. And that was sort of always my philosophy as a journalist, was that I was less interested in what was happening kind of in these faraway closed off rooms and more what was happening sort of like right in my immediate community. And also for selfish reasons, just because I think that made me feel a little bit more connected to the world and less up in like a spaceship Earth and more down rooted with what was actually going on.
So I read a piece you wrote in the Washington Post last year on climate grief. And I very much relate to it. And in it, you say that you don't like hope and that you think hope is something that needs to be cultivated. We can't sit back and wait for the superheroes to save us. That was sort of what I took from it. Mm-hmm. I'm curious if you think that we are stewarding a seed of hope in dealing in climate action today. You wrote that a year ago. How do you feel about it now?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's such a personal question, like, because I think that for how I understand hope, which is kind of an idea that I took from the poet Ross Gay in an interview he did with Krista Tippett a really long time ago. But I think that a lot of how I have come to understand hope is something that you cultivate, like, in spite of the way that the world is or in spite of how structural forces are not working towards a better world that we all want to live in. And so I think I don't have a good answer for that for anyone other than myself. And I think for myself, I would say yes, because some of the work that I've been doing in the last year has been a little bit more like action oriented and tangible rather than staying in the world of writing and journalism. So for me, that's been like a hopeful pivot, I guess.
You mentioned that you're getting more into action and less on the writing side. I'm actually really curious what you have been pivoting towards and maybe why, if you felt like that was a new way to engage or a better way to engage.
Yeah, this is more like related to like a personal career shift that I had over the last year, which is that I exited the world of like daily journalism and entered research at a nonprofit. And I think that switch has been really good for me because I think one of the things that constantly, and I still write, like I'm still writing a lot of, you know, essays and that type of stuff. But I think a lot of the thing that stressed me out so much as a journalist was this act of constant witnessing, but not being able to turn that witnessing into like personal action always. I'm still in a research role, which is more of like a knowledge production role and not like as much of a hands-on role as, you know, service delivery might be. But I think that research in a nonprofit context has been more personally fulfilling.
Are you working in a climate space in that or an environmental space?
Yeah. I'm in the climate space.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, we're all just personally for reflecting. I don't know. I take an existential line all the time that every day I'm waking up and I'm just checking in with myself. Is this the thing I should be doing, or, you know, the range of choices that I have, of course, within like the constraints of having to exist, right? Materially speaking and things like that. But I think a lot of us that are working in this climate space in various different ways go back and forth on like, to what degree do I feel like I'm, I don't know, facilitating things I shouldn't be or not, you know, taking up responsibilities I should be.
I also relate to that because like before I was a journalist, I was also in academia. I used to teach like an environmental, or I was a teaching assistant for an environmental politics class. And I remember like one of the moments that I felt very engaged. I love teaching, but I felt very engaged with that concept with my students was when I had a student email me after the end of the course being like, how do you go on like with this every day? Because I feel like this course was like paralyzing for me. And that was when I started to like think really a lot about this concept of hope, because I wanted something to tell her. And I sent her a super long email that she probably didn't expect, like in response to her short email that she sent me. But one of the things that I included in that email was like that quote from Ross Gay. And I have it right here. Actually, I pulled it up. And what he said was, sometimes I think there's a, he was talking about joy, but I think it's very intimately connected with hope. And what he said was, sometimes I think there's a conception of joy as meaning something easy. And to me, joy has nothing to do with ease. It is joy by which the labor that will make the life that I want possible. So it is not at all puzzling to me that joy is possible in the midst of difficulty.
For the rest of the episode, we're going to be speaking with two people who actually went to the last COP in person at the end of last year. The first is our friend Kian Mintz-Wu, who is assistant professor of philosophy at University College Cork in Ireland.
So, Kian, it's not your first time at a COP. So I'm wondering if there was anything distinct about this COP in particular compared to the other ones you've been in, or if you want to tell folks which other ones you've went to, if you saw a certain continuity or a certain break with this one.
Absolutely. So I was at COP26, which is in Glasgow 2 years ago, and it was very different. And it was different in a couple of dimensions, but the obvious ones are that this COP in Dubai was really, really well organized, whereas in Glasgow, things were a little bit more seat of your pants. And of course, the other difference that is really important is that this COP had a very large industry presence, a large private sector presence, and a relatively small number of academics, which means that for those of us who were academics and lucky enough to be there, it felt extra important and especially extra valuable, our presence there, because there were a few of us. And I was invited to some fancy, you know, cocktail drinks from private equity firms and so forth, which none of which I went to, although I was kind of curious once or twice, but I didn't end up going to any.
I'm curious if you see that as a, like, I guess there's a negative way to see that as, well, there's a less serious research going on, or academics are getting cut out, or the conversation's sort of moving to more lame duck kind of agreements. But there's also a positive way you could look at it, and you could say, hey, this is finally interacting more and more with the real world. There's something more practical. You have to get industry in there. You got to get industry on board for anything to happen. So do you see it as a successful evolution or de-evolution?
I do think that there are two sides to it. I think on the one hand, I think having relatively few academics means that the scientific voice is a little bit quieter. And that's something that I think is lamentable. But on the other hand, absolutely. Both, it's important to have people that have practical experience and power in the real world, which often comes with money and corporate strength. But there's also another way of thinking about it, which is that if the various private sector entities did not think that COP was important, they wouldn't bother to spend the money that takes to send large delegations there. So that suggests that at least some companies think that it is important what happens at COP. And I think that that should suggest to others that it's important what happens at COP. And so I think that that is an indirect signal that COP matters.
Did you feel like there's that kind of same, I guess, balance between, I don't know, let's say positive or negatives in terms of that involvement with the language that came out, particularly in the formal negotiations and agreements? Of course, you know, a lot of the coverage is on this idea that a phase out kind of language would be stronger, that, you know, the calls to action, which are actual legal jargon themselves, they've used the weakest form of that language that could be used, which, you know, of course, could make contributions optional and things like that. But of course, there is the celebration that the language of fossil fuels got into it to begin with. Is this like a similar thing where it's like, okay, we have to celebrate this on the one hand and be pessimistic about it? I mean, how are you kind of dealing with these double edges?
We should understand that there are political and social limitations on what can be done, and also not expect that COP can do all of the work that we want to be done. Climate change involves many different actors at many different spatial temporal scales working towards a common goal. And what COP does at its best is it sets a direction of travel. It says that very many countries with large amounts of power and powerful people within those countries can agree that we are moving, for example, towards a transition away from fossil fuels. And so we would be happier if they said, no, we're going to move there quickly, or here's a time frame that's really short, or something like this. But it tells other actors, not necessarily that they have to stop, but it just sets up the signal that there is going to be a transition, and therefore you shouldn't expect that fossil fuel free-for-all will continue indefinitely. And I think that that's an important message, even if not as strong as I would like or many other activists that I was there with would have liked. But I think that, frankly, expecting that, or hoping even, that there would have been a phase-out language in the final agreement was overly ambitious.
So it seems like one of the successes of this COP and the existing language is greater data accessibility, and countries will provide more data on drawdown from fossil fuels and a number of climate financing mechanisms. I'm curious, as a philosopher, where is morality in that sort of story of negotiation? And do you think that it's, is it being left behind, or are we taking it with us in that sort of focus on data?
So for the policy nerds, this was the first global stock take, often just abbreviated GST. So that means where all the countries were coming to announce what they had done and hopefully encourage each other to be more ambitious in subsequent years. And it, with all of this data, there is the reasonable question, is that what does the data serve, and are there important roles for philosophers to play? And I think the answer is absolutely yes, there are important things for philosophers to do. And what philosophers should do is, that data tells us what has happened, but it doesn't give us any normative content in the sense of what, in what respect might more ambition be warranted. And so in the policy discussion, there's discussion of historical responsibility, things like contraction and convergence, which means countries getting towards the same level of emissions over time and so forth. But I think that without a strong philosophical conceptual structure, there's a lot of talking past each other. There's a lot of unrecognized assumptions in these debates. What kinds of things are you measuring? What are you taking to be important? And why are you taking, for example, certain kinds of distributions to be of moral importance? And so what I think philosophy can do, and this is what I have tried to do in some small way in some of my own work, is to indicate what kind of structures would be helpful for showing where we stand in that space. And I think that that's something that hopefully philosophers can contribute to. And that doesn't necessarily mean telling the negotiators what you're doing is unjust or morally wrong, although sometimes it may be, but it's more just sort of making it clear how these various commitments speak to each other, where they agree and where they differ. And I think that mapping that out is something that we're both trained to do and is actually really important. And in, certainly in the rooms that I'm in, I've managed to find spaces where philosophers are welcomed.
So now we're going to talk to an economist, Professor Laura Marsigliani, who's a colleague of mine at Durham University.
Well, I'm curious, just from your perspective, being at three of the conferences of the parties now, what was different about COP28 to you? Was there something that felt new, or something that got you excited or pessimistic, or sort of what felt unusual this time around?
Thank you. So I'm an economist. So I'm going to answer as an economist, right? And so Dubai started as the COP when the global stock take was to be concluded. And, you know, it's a legally binding process from the Paris Agreement through which each country is presented their national contribution. And that means all the plans for mitigating carbon emissions, but also on other policies, also on adaptation policies, and they're presented their track record and so on. So you can imagine lots of data were presented, lots of measurements. So it was very exciting to see how all this data all these indicators were presented and how they were used to form the consensus on both individual, as I said, individual commitments to curb greenhouse gas emissions, but also at the global level, because the global target, as everyone knows, is not to generate global warming in terms of climate change at the level that is beyond the 1.5 degrees centigrade with respect to pre-industrial levels. And then, of course, each individual countries within the global targets have to commit to their own mitigation adaptation targets and policies. So it was extremely intriguing to see all of this. And another thing that fueled my imagination was that in addition to the environmental track record, as you might want to call it, the global stocktake in terms of environmental targets and how those were fulfilled, there was lots of discussion around what was called the global agenda stocktake. And this, to me, was very significant because it was absolutely the first time that this was discussed, although at the last few COPs, the role of gender equality and other EDI considerations were brought to the arena, to the discussion arena. But for the first time, the country committed to provide this data about the inclusivity of climate policies. And this was extremely important because it recognized that any transition to net zero economies and so on needs to be done in an inclusive manner. And we need to foster, in other words, just a transition to net zero. Not just a transition, but a transition that is inclusive and is just, it doesn't disadvantage different groups. Can be women, can be maybe other more vulnerable groups as well.
I was really intrigued because it seemed like part of the innovations of Paris was this idea of being able to have this notion, a new notion or new framework for responsibility, particularly around the fact that countries could self-differentiate their responsibilities and capabilities. And so now it seems around finance, and this is coming up in the loss and damage conversation, though most of the responsibility, for example, around loss and damage hang on the global north countries. And now there's these kinds of conversations about whether emergent economies or large-scale economies like China or Saudi Arabia should be also on the hook as far as responsibility. But the kind of overall challenge is that there actually isn't really a clear definition between developing and developed countries in order to try to understand that responsibility distribution. Do you see any kind of challenges or foresee any kind of shifting in terms of our understanding about responsibility, particularly when it comes to climate finance contributions? Or was that something new that maybe developed in this COP?
Yes, recognizing that developing countries are contribute massively because they possess the large majority of natural capital in the world, I think it's fundamental because that changes all the nature of transaction, financial transaction as well. For example, think about an African country coming into the negotiation and say, okay, you know, we're already contributing in cleaning up the environment and we're contributing to solve the problem that you developed country have created since the Industrial Revolution. We're looking at the historical emission track record and so on. So and we're contributing because the ecosystem services that we're providing to the entire global community, therefore, we need to be valued. And in other words, when you invest in programs in our country from, you know, this transfer of finance from developed to developing country. So the price that you're going to pay for this privilege you invest in our country has to be much higher.
Yeah, hot take after thinking about it for a while, so maybe not so much of a hot
take. Lukewarm take.
Is that... My lukewarm take, it's been sitting on the counter for a bit, is that rather than kind of going back and forth with this question of good cop, bad cop, right, and having to answer like whether or not we find these cops to be successful, that maybe that's starting to become a sort of category error of question.
Yeah.
And rather just ask ourselves, like, what is it doing? And is what it's doing shifting? So I'm more curious about like the evolutions of maybe the space that it's taking up, just from a you know, curiosity standpoint. And then in light of asking that question of what should it be doing, what ought it be doing, then we can ask the sort of evaluative or normative question of whether it's good or bad. Sure. So I feel like just taking a step back maybe and rethinking that not all climate action is going to run through multilateral negotiations. And so if it's not effective in some respects, where are the other pieces that we need in the puzzle?
Well, and most climate action isn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
Most climate action is going to happen at a much more local level.
Right.
But I do think that these international negotiations are as much a reflection as they are a motivation.
Yeah, going that's a forward, helpful way of thinking about
right?
it.
Right? Mm-hmm. So I think they're a good opportunity to see where the global community is at sort of right. that highest level. And I just don't think that we're where we need to be. If the global community is just now getting back to that, well, we got to transition away. I think we need to sort of pull a lot harder on a lot of levers going forward.
Well, maybe one thing, too, that comes back to that question of is it successful in light of what is it supposed to be doing? I am worried about a particular trend, which is that there's a move away from, or at least it seems like a discerned attempt to overfocus on information and data.
Yeah.
Now, not so much about just data about climate change, but around data with respect to our actual NDCs, right? And what yeah. kinds of policies that we're doing. And I'm really worried that then what gets dropped out are the questions of justice, are the normative considerations. And this is like that same eternal return of this argument that we can't both address questions of justice and move quick enough on climate action. That tension seems to, what's winning out in that tension seems to be the, let's then ignore those sticky, hard questions about justice and compensation, et cetera.
Well, I'll be optimistic here for a second. I mean, like the flip
side. Oh, we're switching roles.
Yeah, look at that. The flip side is that like with new data does come novelty, right? So there is an opportunity in novelty for new kinds of problem solving. So the fact that the global stock take has taken center stage and that all of this information is so widely available hopefully will open up new pathways for new kinds of policy and new kinds of action that will address issues of enfranchisement and justice and the real social elements of climate change that are worrying, right? So I think there's some hope there. I mean, I have sort of this like deeper political worry or concern that like we mark these historic international negotiations based on their purely political context and merits, rather than judging them against the practical backdrop of implementation and like people's lives, right?
Like whether emissions are actually going down or whether adaptation
exactly.
is being facilitated.
Right. So like yeah. things like, well, Kyoto and Paris and now Dubai are these historic moments in international climate negotiation. And yet the temperature keeps rising. Right. So we have them like the way we're assessing them is in political terms. But climate change is not at its heart merely a political problem. There are political dimensions to it as a problem. Right. But it is a environmental problem. It's a social problem. It's a really practical problem that shows up in our lives. It is a multifaceted problem that like itself doesn't care if we get the politics right. you know, like the thermometer doesn't care.
Right.
I mean, if I fast forward, I could imagine like a very successful historic international agreement that is much more aggressive than Paris, that goes much further than this year in terms of language, that says, hey, like we're going to be a net zero global economy. We're going to do that next year and then we achieve it. Like, let's just imagine like pie in the sky, what happens. And let's say this happens in like 30 years. It could be politically very successful, but in the meantime, if it takes another 30 years to get there, it's also entirely possible that the environmental and social context in which that happens is such that we've had these sort of massive climate burdens along the way that are just sort of that end up being the backdrop of that, where like okay, if like global food production has to change, and if mobility patterns have to change, and if coastlines have to change, right? If I don't want to be doomist here, because I don't think that's the right way to approach the problem either. But I just think that there are practical constraints that we need to come back to.
Well, and this is this, I mean, right, this is doing to some extent non-ideal or maybe some level of constrained ideal theorizing in the context of certain conditions, right? Those conditions are not just feasibility questions, but also the range of tools that are available, right, in international negotiation. How much do those structures need to shift? How much of a status quo is available?
Things like language get pushed to the forefront.
Exactly, right. And then, so there's a question, right, and this is a thing I'm constantly contending with, which is, you know, how much of the status quo is a hindrance? How much does it provide a set of resources, right? Or are we looking at needing the development of new different kinds of institutions? Or how much can we make better the old institutions? So like one axe that I have to grind is, you know, this whole narrative that continues over time, again, another type of eternal return argument, is the role of the fossil fuel industry in the transition, right, in these negotiations. I feel like we have substantial evidence, right, to show why that's a hindrance, right? And so this is a question of, like, should these international institutions that worked really hard to kind of bring different industries within to the fold, like, now do we have a question about, like, well, how much are we going to still put, like, oil execs as the president of COP going forward, or continue to have it in heavy fossil fuel industry states?
Yeah, I mean, like, maybe here's where I'm at with it. Like, COP seems like, you know, even when it's really great, we just immediately move on to the next edition. Right now, volume 28. We're just waiting for now, volume 29.
Jesus.
I kind of think that as we look for a constellation of institutions and a constellation of actions to engage in problem solving, we need to be really aware of what burns oxygen in the global room. Maybe I'm mixing metaphors here, but so much attention goes to COP that then we don't have the same conversation around meeting between major global cities. We don't have necessarily the same energy for our conversations around, like, municipal climate action plans. We don't have the same energy to engage with, like, the nitty-gritty wonky transportation policy questions. We don't have the same energy to even talk about, like personal behavior change and individual responsibilities.
So what you're saying is, like, we lose when it's so highly concentrated within an international governance mechanism. In that kind of high level nation states, you lose out on the sort of scalar complexity and also opportunity.
And that's a generalization, because, like, obviously not everybody loses out on that. Not every,
yeah, sure.
It's not like a complete barrier to these other institutions. But I do think that we should maybe flip the importance placed on international negotiation, and we should place a lot more importance on local action. And local decision making and engagement.
Yeah, because a lot of where global climate action is going to happen, right, whether it's adaptation and also in the case of mitigation, right, will also happen with all the kind of fraught or also, you know, beneficial resources that happen at the local level. And just maybe I'll do a shout out really quick. C40, you know, is this global network, right, of 100 mayors of the world's leading cities. So in a way, right, it has this kind of international structure, but they're coming together and are united in action to confront climate crisis. And there's been a tremendous amount of really interesting and productive work that's been happening at that level. So that's, like, international, but at the scale of mayors, right?
Totally. Well, and you know what happens when you get that kind of, like, local governance engaged in international, because it's not international negotiations, it's sort of international coordination and collaboration.
Exactly.
Rather than spending so much time trying to figure out what language everyone can agree to, which is sort of this impossible task of incommensurable values and just different value structures, everybody disagrees on language and moves on. Everyone says it doesn't matter if we agree on the language. Instead, who's got the most efficient infrastructure to solve this municipal problem? And there might be 10 reasons why, if you're the mayor of a city, you want to look at that as an option for your city. And they're not all even going to be climate related. But you get down to a very nitty gritty practical kind of problem solving that I think moves things ahead. Even when we focus really narrowly on climate action at the local level, we can disagree on every element of language, and we chalk that up to a different conversation, and we just ask, well, like, what do we want to do about this particular local problem right now today? Where do we want our power to come from next year? Where do we want our food to come from? How do we, exactly?
Right. So there's more of an opportunity, or there's actually like financial resources, right, that are given to communities to be able to participate in that kind of co-collaboration, identifying co-benefits in certain projects, right? Really a more bottom-up approach that may not be able to be possible, right, at that higher scale or that international governance level.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, next year, I don't know if we should do another episode on COP29. I think we should do an episode on municipal climate action plans. I think that gets the airtime.
I'm pretty amped to talk about grids. I'm pretty amped to talk about sustainable housing. I want to nerd out about nature-based solutions.
Let's go.
So I feel like there's a lot we can talk about. I mean, I am very still continuously curious on how that climate finance mechanism is going to work with L&D in the next COP.
Okay,
so can
maybe
we
we'll talk about COP29.
I still want to, can we check in on the Green Climate
maybe
Fund?
Maybe we'll talk about COP29.
Okay. We don't have
to
abandon it.
If at first you don't succeed,
COP
just
again.
Just try 29 more times.
We will get
there. And then we'll get there.
Thanks so much for listening to A Hostile Climate. The show is hosted by me, Simona Capizani, and Alex Lee. Our show is produced and edited by Cody Nelson. Our theme music is by Mark Shapiro, and our show art is by Jean Julien. A Hostile Climate is an independently produced podcast, and we count on listeners like you to help us keep making more episodes. If you'd like to donate to support the show, you can find information on our website, ahostileclimate.org. And please make sure you're subscribed on any or all of your podcast platforms of choice. If you like what you hear, leave us a 5-star rating. Tell a friend. It really helps us out. Thanks again. See you next time.